How do you respond to other people's tragedies? What do you do? What do you think when you see in the news that there's some tragedy that occurred in a different part of the world, whether it's a natural disaster or a terrorist attack or something like that? How do you respond? How do you respond to an individual's personal tragedy? Maybe it's some famous person. Maybe it's a politician that you don't like. How do you respond when something bad happens to that person? What goes through your mind? Well, there are a number of ways to respond to tragedies. One is with compassion and acts of service. That's really the best way. But other people don't respond in that kind of way. Some people have an opposite reaction. There's this interesting German word, Schadenfreude, which literally means joy, Freude, that comes at the expense of other people's misfortunes, Schaden. So when you see something bad happening to someone that you don't like, you're kind of secretly in glee. You're happy. Sometimes when something bad happens, the tendency is to blame the victims. And you say, well, that happened because they did this and they deserve that. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina, which hit part of the Gulf Coast in 2005, various religious leaders blamed the hurricane on various sins. This is what was written in Time magazine about that tendency. An ultra-conservative Israeli rabbi declared that Katrina was retribution for U.S. support of the Israeli pullout from Gaza. Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam called Katrina judgment for the Iraq War. The Christian Civic Group of Maine noted that the hurricane struck just as New Orleans was planning a huge gay rights festival. A Kuwaiti official said, "The terrorist Katrina is one of the soldiers of Allah." There was, in other words, broad agreement in some far-reaching quarters that Katrina represented God's punishment, but no consensus on the sin. It's interesting how all these different religious leaders knew for certain why Hurricane Katrina happened. Others take a very different approach, and they say, well, something bad happened, and that's because it was outside of God's hands. There was a rabbi, Harold Kushner, I guess he was and still lives in Natick, famously wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he came to the conclusion that God is not all-powerful. God is not all-powerful, so he can't stop certain things from happening. And concerning Hurricane Katrina, he said this, God was not in the hurricane. So apparently God is not only not all-powerful, according to Harold Kushner, but he's also not omnipresent. For some people, when tragedies strike, they despair, and they think there's just no hope. There's no meaning to this thing that happened. There's no good end to it. Not only is God not all-powerful, but he can't help people pick up the pieces afterward. Well, today we're going to see how Job's friends responded to his tragedy, how Job responded to their own responses and his tragedy, and how he speaks to God. And 2 weeks ago, we began the book. If you weren't here, I'll try to recap as quickly as I can how the book of Job begins. Roughly 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, there was a man named Job living somewhere in the Middle East, and he was a righteous man. He worshiped God, and God had blessed him. God had given him wealth. He had a great amount of animals and servants, and he also had a very large family, a wife and 10 children. Now, behind the scenes, Job doesn't know this, but in heaven, God and Satan have this conversation. And God says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him. He's blameless." And Satan says, "The reason Job fears you is because you've given him all these good things. But if you take away all those good things, he will curse you to your face." God says, "Okay, you can take away all those good things, but don't touch him." And then we see in the next scene, all of Job's animals die, all his servants die, and his 10 children die. Yet Job did not curse God. He mourned, but he also worshiped. So we go back to a scene in heaven, and God says again to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him." And Satan says, "Well, the reason he hasn't cursed you yet is because his body hasn't been affected yet. But if you would strike his body, then he will curse you." So God says, "Okay, you can touch his body, you can do whatever you want with him, just don't kill him." And then somehow Satan gave Job this terrible skin condition. He had boils and sores and all kinds of awful things happening to his skin. And yet still, Job did not curse God. And then we find that his three friends, who came from a distance, come to comfort him. The friends' names are Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And there's a reason why no one names their kids those names, as we'll find out. And then, that was all in chapters 1 and 2. And then chapter 3, we looked at last week, Job just kind of laments, cries out. He wishes that he had never been born or that he had been born stillborn. He wishes that he were dead because life is so awful. And that brings us to what happens next in this whole book, which are three cycles of dialogues between the friends and Job. And today we're going to look at the first cycle. And because these cycles are kind of repetitive, we're going to take the whole first one, even though there's a lot of chapters, and then the next 2 weeks we'll look at the other two. Each cycle has one friend speaking to Job, and then Job responds, and then the next friend, and then Job responds, and then the next friend, and Job responds, and then they do this two more times, going round and round. I won't have time to read each verse in this long passage that we're looking at today, so I'm going to read some of the key verses and summarize. I'll move kind of quickly. So what I want you to do is turn in the Bible to the book of Job. If you brought your own Bible, that's great. The book of Job is right before the book of Psalms. If you didn't bring your own Bible, that's okay. We have a lot of them available. And I do encourage you to look along because that's going to help you kind of stay on track and make better sense of what I'm saying. And we'll start in Job chapter 4, which is on page 418 in the Bible here. Page 418, Job chapter 4. The first of his friends, named Eliphaz, starts to speak. And I want us to look at the first six verses of his speech. "Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, 'If one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Yet who can keep from speaking? Behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who is stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?'" So Eliphaz begins by saying, "Look, don't be impatient with me." Doesn't seem to be a very sensitive approach to someone who's mourning and grieving. And he does say some nice things about Job. You've helped strengthen weak hands and so forth. And he says, "Look, Job, isn't your fear of God your confidence despite what's happening?" But the key thing in Eliphaz's philosophy is found in verses 7 and 8. This is really his message to Job. "Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." So he's saying, look, we know that no innocent person has ever perished. And the implication is, Job, you're not innocent. That's why you're suffering. You are reaping something that you have sowed. So he assumes that Job has done something bad to deserve all this. Even though, like I said before, we're told that Job has not done anything to deserve this. He's blameless. Now, all three of the friends have some slightly different points to make, but each one of them assumes that Job is basically getting what he deserves and that he is guilty. He's done something wrong. And they believe in something called the principle of retribution. You do bad things, and bad things will happen to you. You reap what you sow. So they think if that's true, then if someone is suffering, bad things are happening to that person, then it must be the case that that person has done something bad to deserve it. They're actually making a mistake with logic, assuming that everyone who is suffering must have sinned, when only the reverse of that is true. Everyone who has sinned will, in one way or another, ultimately suffer. They assume that Job must have done something to deserve this. They can't imagine that there would be some other reason why he would suffer in this way. Again, they don't know the conversation that God had with Satan. They don't understand that Job is suffering because God is trying to prove a point to Satan, that there is this man who worships me because of who I am, not because of the good stuff I've given to him. And I think God is also having Job suffer to show Job something. And in the end, we're going to see that, but we won't talk about that this week. Let's look at what Eliphaz says next, in verses 12 through 19 of chapter 4. He says, "Now a word was brought to me stealthily. My ear received the whisper of it. Amid thoughts from visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, dread came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. Then I heard a voice. Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? Even in his servants he puts no trust, and his angels he charges with error. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed like the moth." Now, Eliphaz claims to have some kind of personal revelation. He had this vision in the night, a dream. There was this spirit, whoever that was, who asks this question, can mortal man be in the right before God? It's an important question. That may be the most important question. A lot of people think, I'm suffering because God must be unhappy with me, or I've done something to deserve this. How can I be in God's good graces? How can I be in the right before him? Well, Eliphaz assumes in his way of thinking about God and the world that every creature is in the wrong just for being a creature. He says, look, God charges his angels with error. How much more is he going to charge human beings who dwell in houses of clay, who are made of dust, be charged with error by God? For him, simply being alive is a sin. Now, in the next chapter, in chapter 5, skipping ahead a little bit, he seems to call Job a fool. And worse than that, he implies that Job's children died because Job is foolish. Look at chapter 5, verse 4. He's speaking of the fool, and he says, "His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there is no one to deliver them." He doesn't score many sensitivity points there. Imagine if all your children died and someone said, "Well, you know they died because you're such a fool." You can't even imagine someone saying that, but this is what Job's friend is saying to him. And then he gives Job some advice in verse 8. He says, "As for me, I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause." In verses 17 and 18, dropping down a bit, he says, "Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves. Therefore, despise not the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up. He shatters, but his hands heal." So he's saying, look, Job, you're a miserable wretch just because you're a human being. Commit yourself to God. Take whatever discipline he's giving to you, and God will heal you, and all will be well. You know, as you might imagine, this doesn't go over particularly well with Job. He's not comforted by his friend's words. And so he starts to express once again how terrible he feels. Job starts speaking in chapter 6. Look at the first four verses. "Then Job answered and said, Oh, that my vexation were weighed and all my calamity laid in the balances, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore, my words have been rash, for the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. He says his vexation weighs more than all the sand of the sea. We have to remember this is all poetry. But the really shocking thing that Job says is in verse 4. He says, the arrows of God are in me, the poisonous arrows. He is terrorizing me. A few verses later, in verse 8 through 10, he says, oh, that I might have my request, and that God would fulfill my hope, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. This would be my comfort. I would even exult in pain unsparing, for I have not denied the words of the Holy One. It says, it would be better for God to crush me right now and just end all this. And he says he's innocent. He has not denied God's words. Then he tells the friends, look how horrible you are. Verse 14, he says, he who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. In other words, you are not being kind to me, and therefore you show that you don't properly fear God. And then in the next verse, verse 15, he says, my brothers are treacherous. Let's look at verses 24 through 27 then. He says, teach me, and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have gone astray. How forceful are upright words. But what does reproof from you reprove? Do you think that you can reprove words when the speech of a despairing man is wind? You would even cast lots over the fatherless and bargain over your friend. So he's saying to his friends, show me where I've gone wrong. Teach me. He says, don't you understand? I'm lamenting that I'm just venting these windy words, and you think you can correct me? Don't you see what I'm going through? You're so terrible that you would even cast lots over orphans and haggle over the price of a brother. In the next few verses, he says he's not lying. He says his vindication is at stake, and he insists that he has committed no injustice. In chapter 7, Job laments his situation even more. He says that he can't find rest or comfort, and that when he dies, he will vanish forever. But then he starts speaking directly to God, not to his friends. And he says God is always watching over him and hounding him, never forgiving him. Let's read chapter 7, verses 11 through 21. Job says, therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or a sea monster that you set a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are a breath. What is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him? Visit him every morning and test him every moment. How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit? If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be. All those verses right there directed to God. Leave me alone. Why don't you forgive me? Job's second friend, then, Bildad, starts to speak. We find his speech in chapter 8. And I'll look at the first 7 verses to see how he begins to talk to Job. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, how long will you say these things? and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. Bildad is saying, Job, you have windy words. You don't know what you're talking about. God indeed is just. And then he again suggests that the children died, but not because of Job's sin, because of their own sin. He's even more insensitive than Eliphaz. But his message is this: if you would only seek out God, he would restore you. If Eliphaz, the first friend, relied on this personal revelation, this dream he had, Bildad appeals to tradition. Verses 8 through 10, he says, "For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, for our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you in utter words of their understanding?" He claims to have the wisdom of the ages with him, the traditions of the fathers. And such tradition says that the hope of the godless will perish, but that God will not forsake a person who repents and comes to him. Well, that's Bildad's speech in a nutshell. In chapter 9, Job responds to Bildad. And he says, it is impossible to contend with God because God is too powerful. And Job starts to wonder, too, how a man can be right before God. So look at verses 2 through 4 of chapter 9. Job says, "Truly, I know that it is so, but how can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded?" Then jump down to verses 15 through 24. As Job continues his speech, he says, "Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him, this is God, and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe my life. It is all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hands of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who then is it?" Notice that Job seems to say, both the innocent and the wicked meet the same fate. It almost doesn't matter if you've done something wrong or not, because who can say anything back to God? He says the earth seems to be given over to wicked people and that God is covering the eyes of judges as if God is preventing justice from happening. Job is coming dangerously close to saying God is unjust. And though Job thinks that God is so powerful that he wouldn't even listen, Job wants more and more to have an audience with God. He wants to speak to God. He wants God to explain himself. But he also thinks that it's of no use because there's no arbiter, there's no mediator between God and himself, although Job desires for such a person. Look down, chapter 9, verses 29 and following. Verse 29, Job says, "I shall be condemned, Why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you will plunge me into a pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. For he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself. I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Again, Job wants God to speak, to answer him. Why am I going through this? But he fears that without some person to come in between both God and him, he won't get an answer. He won't be able to speak. God won't listen. Job feels like he's being condemned without a trial. And he wants to enter into a courtroom with God. And he needs to have some kind of attorney, some kind of judge to step in between them and moderate that trial. So that's Job's second speech. Now we get to the third friend, a man named Zophar. And he speaks in chapter 11. Let's look at the first half of his speech. We'll read the first 12 verses of chapter 11. Then Zophar, the Namathite, answered and said, should a multitude of words go unanswered and a man full of talk be judged right? Should your babble silence men? And when you mock, shall no one shame you? For you say, my doctrine is pure and I am clean in God's eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom, for he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It is higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol. What can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes through and imprisons and summons the court, who can turn him back? For he knows worthless men. When he sees iniquity, will he not consider it? But a stupid man will get understanding when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. Zophar, like the others, assumes that Job is guilty. If God would speak to Job, he would show that Job is actually getting less than what he deserves. But Zophar's main point is God's wisdom is beyond our wisdom. And he even suggests that Job is worthless and stupid. Again, a wonderful friend. At the end of his speech, Zophar says that if only Job would reach out to God and stop sinning, then all would be well. But the wicked will perish. This provokes Job's response in chapters 12 through 14, the last speech that we'll be looking at today. In chapter 12, Job begins to respond to his friends with a bit of sarcasm. Look at verses 2 and 3. No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these? So his friends may think they're so wise, but Job says, I know a thing or two as well. And one thing he says is that the wicked do not always suffer in this life. So look at verse 6 of chapter 12. He says, the tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand. So you look at these robbers, these people who provoke God, these idolaters, they seem to be fine. And what Job is saying is, if the wicked don't always suffer, then how do you know that those who are suffering are wicked? Life doesn't always work that way. He says God sometimes decides to do things because he can. And so in the next few verses later on, he says, God is the one who raises up kings and nations, and God's the one who overturns them. God is free to do whatever he wants. Look at verses 12 through 15. Wisdom is with the aged, an understanding in length of days. With God are wisdom and might. He is counsel and understanding. If he tears down, none can rebuild. If he shuts a man in, none can open. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the land. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away stripped, and judges he makes fools. He looses the bonds of kings and binds a waistcloth on their hips. He leads priests away stripped and overthrows the mighty. He deprives of speech those who are trusted and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on princes and loosens the belt of the strong. He uncovers the deeps out of darkness and brings deep darkness to light. He makes nations great and he destroys them. He enlarges nations and leads them away. He takes away understanding from the chiefs of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a trackless waste. They grope in the dark without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. Job's friends assume that God works in a very mechanical way. Someone has done this, and God immediately does that. And Job says, no, look, God has the freedom to do whatever he wants to do. He does not always work in such a mechanical way. He doesn't always work in the way that we can predict. In chapter 13, Job tells his friends, again, that they are terrible friends. So, chapter 13, verses 1 through 5, he says, behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you whitewash with lies. Worthless physicians are you all. Oh, that you would keep silent, and it would be your wisdom. Job says, I want to speak to God, not you. You all are worthless physicians. Verse 12, he says that their maxims are proverbs of ashes. Their words are no good to him. And he begins to focus his attention directly on God once again. He wants to make his case before God, even if it means he's going to die. So verses 13 through 15. Let me have silence, and I will speak, and let come on me what may. Why should I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hand? Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Yet I will argue my ways to his face. That last verse, the verse 15, it could be translated, if he were to slay me, I would have no hope. There's a little note in the ESV here that indicates that. Most commentators think that's the original reading. But as we'll see next week, Job does maintain some hope. Even though he thinks God is not acting fairly to him and he doesn't understand what's happening, he has hope that he will see God in the flesh. So even though he's wrestling with God and he's complaining and saying things that seem like great accusations against God, he's doing that in some kind of faith and ultimate trust in God. And ultimately, he says, I want to make my case before God. And he says that on and on in the rest of the chapter. He wants an answer from God. He wants to know what his sins are. He wants to know why God is treating him this way as an enemy. And in chapter 14, he basically says, if it's going to go on this way, it would be better if I were dead. Now that we've kind of looked very quickly at those speeches, I just want to draw a few conclusions for us. I want us to see three main things. One of the obvious points in all of this is how terrible Job's friends are. How poorly they handle a man who is grieving. Instead of comforting him, they accuse him. They're like all those religious pontificators that I mentioned earlier talking about why Hurricane Katrina happened. But of course, they know. They're so confident that Job has done something wrong, and that's why this is happening to him. What they're doing in accusing Job in this way is a great evil. I think they're actually continuing the work of Satan. We only hear the word Satan in the first two chapters of this book of Job, but though we don't hear his name, it doesn't mean he stops working. He is the one who is the accuser. That's part of what he does. He wants God's people to feel condemned. So when these worthless physicians, these miserable comforters, Job's friends, say, "You've done wrong to deserve this," they're actually doing what he wants. You know, maybe that spirit that Eliphaz saw in his dream was not the Holy Spirit. Maybe it was an evil spirit. What's interesting is his friends say, "Do this, confess some sin," which he hadn't committed, "and then God will reward you with good things, with a long life and pleasure and so on." What they're doing by trying to get Job to confess in order to earn good things from God is actually to carry out what Satan had said at the very beginning. Remember, Satan said to God, "The reason Job fears you is because you've given him good stuff." If Job did something false, confessed a sin that he hadn't committed, in order to get good things from God, he would be proving Satan's point. So his friends are doing the work of Satan. Now think of what happened during the life of Jesus, the Son of God, when he was on the earth. He was tempted by Satan towards the beginning of his ministry. You find that in Matthew 4, Luke 4. And how did Satan tempt Jesus? By offering him good things, the kingdoms of the world. And yet Jesus does not buy into that. He denies Satan, and Satan flees. But that doesn't mean that Satan was done working. Satan starts to work through all of the Pharisees, the scribes, all these religious leaders of the day who come to Jesus to test him and to trap him in his own words. And when that fails, they just decide they're going to get rid of him. So they conspire with one of Jesus' friends, Judas Iscariot. And they get Judas to betray Jesus, to get him arrested away from the city, away from the crowds who might cause a riot. And we're told very explicitly that Satan worked through Judas when he betrayed Jesus. In a similar way, Job's friends are doing the work of Satan. So when tragedy strikes, the lesson that we can learn is to not be like them. We don't need to accuse people of sin. We don't need to say, "Well, that earthquake happened because these people were terrible. They did this, that thing, or the other." We don't need to say, "You know, this terrorist attack occurred because these people provoked God." Now, tragedies can happen because they're God's judgment. We do know that evil happens in the world, and ultimately we die because of the sin in the world. But that doesn't mean that we know why an earthquake or a hurricane or some terrorist attack occurred. We don't know the specific reason behind that. In Jesus' day, there was a man who was born blind. And some people said to him, "Hey, why is that guy blind? Was it because his parents sinned or because he sinned?" What did Jesus say? He said, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him." And then Jesus healed the man. Sometimes bad things can be a judgment for sin. Sometimes bad things happen because God has other plans. He has other purposes. He wants to display his power or his mercy or to help his people grow in their faith. We don't know exactly why, so we don't need to speculate. It's better to just go alongside people who are hurting and weep with them and do good things for them. We should be compassionate. We should be humble. We should be like Job's friends when they came and sat with him for a week. They started off well. The second thing I want us to think about is this. When we read through Job, and if you read all of it, you see that the words that Job says about God or directly to God can be really shocking. He says some very strong things about God. God is shooting arrows into me. He's crushing me. He's terrorizing me. And it seems like Job's accusing God of doing wrong. How do we make sense of this and harmonize that with Job's supposed blameless character? The best thing I read about this was from a man named Peter Kreft. He says, God is infinite love, and the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. Job's love for God is infected with hate, but the three friends' love for God is infected with indifference. Here's a great line. Job stays married to God and throws dishes at him. The three friends have a polite non-marriage with separate bedrooms and separate vacations. The family that fights together stays together. Again, Job's friends, kind of, they talk about God. They don't talk to God. They just talk about him. And they act as if he's almost just a concept, an idea, and a very mechanical force. This happens, God responds this way. This happens, God responds that way. The thing that Job knows is that God is free to do what he wills. Now, he doesn't understand everything of what God is doing, and sometimes it seems like Job has the wrong idea. But he's wrestling with God, and he's doing that with some faith, with some trust. He doesn't walk away from God. He doesn't say, well, God is terrible because this happened, and I will never speak to him again. He doesn't say, this has happened to me, therefore this whole notion of God must be false. There is no God. He says, I want to speak to God. God, why are you doing this? Give me an answer. When we're going through difficult things, it is okay to wrestle with God. Ask him questions. Tell him how you're feeling. He already knows. Tell him you don't like it. He can handle it. As you're wrestling, you're probably going to come to a place where you have a deeper trust in God. You may understand some of the thoughts you had in the past were wrong. But as you wrestle, God will bring you into a right place. And here's the last thing, the third thing I want to see. This question that comes up, we've seen it a couple times, it'll come up later in the book. Can a man be in the right before God? How can human beings, we're finite creatures, be reconciled to our Creator? All of us have sinned at some point, or repeatedly. We have rejected God. We've ignored Him. Oftentimes, we know what's right, and we don't care at the moment because we want something else, and so we do what we know to be wrong. And the Bible very clearly says that the punishment ultimately for sin is death. And that may seem very strong, but sin is basically a slap in God's face. And not only is sin that, sin destroys God's creation, the world that He originally made good. Sin hurts other people, it hurts ourselves, and God cannot be a good God and allow sin to keep going forever and flourish. If God wants to reclaim His creation and restore it, He's got to root out all of the evil, dig up all the weeds so His garden can be the way it ought to be. So how can we, who've done evil, stand before God? When we come to the end of our lives, that is what's going to happen. We will all be accountable for what we've done. Is there hope? Job thinks that he needs an arbiter, some kind of mediator, but he doesn't think there's anyone who qualifies. After all, who's going to come in and tell God what to do? Now, though Job didn't see that there's a mediator, we know that there is one. And his name is Jesus. He's both God and man, and he is perfect. He never sinned. He never ignored God. He never did what was wrong. And he is our advocate. For all who come to him and trust him, he represents us. And as the Apostle Paul writes in 1 Timothy 2, verses 5 and 6, there is one God and there is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself as a ransom for all, which is the testimony given at the proper time. Again, we've all sinned, and we need someone to ransom us out of our slavery to sin and the condemnation that we deserve. And the only person who can do that, who the only one who's qualified, is Jesus, who is both God and man, perfect in every way, able to represent us. When he lived the perfect life. When he died, he was treated as a criminal, not because he'd done anything wrong, but because it was God's plan for someone to die in our place, someone to bear God's right, holy, just punishment for sin, someone to drink the bitter cup of God's wrath. So when Jesus died, it wasn't just a painful death, though it was that, but it was a supernaturally painful death. He took on all of the punishment that evil deserves, so that everyone who comes to him and loves him and is united to him by faith has all their evil paid for already, all their sins punished, and they are credited with his perfect life. And Jesus didn't just die, he rose from the grave, showing that there's life after death for God's people, that all of God's people will one day in the future have a resurrection of their own and live in a perfect world. So we do have an arbiter. We do have someone who comes in between God and us and reconciles us. We may not understand what's going on in life, but we cannot say that God doesn't care. We cannot say that there isn't someone who will represent us before God. We have that person. His name is Jesus. And if we're united to him by faith, we won't have to stand in trial before God. We won't go on trial because Jesus already went on trial for us. And the question for us again is, do we love Jesus and trust him and follow him simply because of who he is? Not because of what he can give us, not because we imagine that he can give us all these riches and fame and everything else, but simply because of who he is. Do we love him that way? Do we trust that he is good? Do we trust that he's God? Do we trust that what he did nearly 2,000 years ago can take care of all the problems that we have? Will we follow him? Let's pray. Father, as we wrestle with this book of Job, we think of his wrestling with you, and we can think about our own wrestling as we go through hard times, things that we don't understand. As we look out in a world where things are wrong and broken and confusing, we may not understand what you're up to. We may be like Job and just thinking you're out to get us. And yet we know that you are good, and the best proof of that is you gave your own son. You did not withhold your own son. You gave him up for us. And if you would do that, you will not withhold the best things for us. You will not withhold yourself. And so I pray that you would help us to trust in you through good times and bad. I pray that you would help us to be friends to people who are suffering and to be not worthless physicians and miserable comforters, but good friends who are loving and kind and compassionate. I pray that you would help us to be more like Jesus. We pray this all in his holy name. Amen.